What's up, Gator Nation?
Good morning, Gator Nation.
You're listening to Gator Nation.
And the Gators have the biggest lead of the day.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WUMT.
From the University of Florida, College of Journalism and Communication.
3, 2, 1, we're live.
Hi, everyone. This is The Communicator, the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications podcast, where we dive into the latest in media, picking the brains of top faculty and staff around the Gator Nation. I'm Matt Abramson, Director of Media Services with Elizabeth and Swasti.
Hi, this is Elizabeth.
Today, we're speaking with Cynthia Barnett, Senior Lecturer and Director of Climate and Environmental Reporting Initiatives in the Department of Journalism and the 2024 UF Undergraduate Teacher of the Year. Thank you for joining us, Cynthia.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us, what is conservation journalism and what sparked your fascination initially with water as a natural resource, but also as a narrative subject?
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so conservation or environmental journalism is a specialization focused on natural systems. So land, wildlife, water, climate change, and so on. So the idea is to help people understand the profound role of the environment on our lives and our impact in turn on the world. So it's kind of this art of how to draw audiences to these stories to give them the knowledge they need to make the best decisions on behalf of the planet and all life. And sort of the quick answer about how I became fascinated with water or obsessed with water is that really I've just always loved water, everything from mud puddles to rainstorms. And as a young journalist, I noticed a lot of really big water decisions being made without public understanding and without accountability. And so that's sort of how it got started. I really sought to cover those stories. And I think over time it became something of an obsession, which happens to journalists.
When it rains, it pours.
Touche.
I feel like that's a good thing, to be obsessed with what you're writing about.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing. So how did your Florida upbringing in particular influence this environmental perspective and your writing voice?
Yeah, so I grew up in both Florida and California, and I think an impactful part of growing up in either of those places is how often you turn around and sort of see some wild place that you loved has become a drugstore or a giant gas station. And from a really young age, I wanted to know who got to decide that. How does that get to happen, and who decides? That's essentially how it starts.
So, Cynthia, you earned your bachelor's degree in journalism from the CJC here at UF.
I did.
How has the ecology of our campus changed, as well as the college itself?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it's just mind-blowing to walk around and see the new buildings that are constantly rising on campus. I mean, you probably feel this way just starting your senior year,
yeah,
right? It's amazing 100%. How much it changes. And so I do think the good thing is that we have a stronger ethos now for sort of preserving natural assets like the tree canopy and the wetlands than we did in the late 80s when I was an undergraduate. So when I walk around, I do think a lot about how students and faculty sort of stood up over the decades to save great places as well as animals here on campus. And I especially love the stories of how Lake Alice was saved from becoming a parking lot, how the bats were saved, and how UF used to have living alligators. The Alberts used to be live mascots. And it was really students who ended up protecting alligators from living in a cage and being abused on the UF campus. So even though there is a great deal of change, I love to think about those stories of what we saved. And I actually teach some of those stories in my classes.
After graduating, you worked as a traditional beat reporter and editor at newspapers and magazines. Did you cover the environment much in those roles?
Yes and no. What's interesting about what has changed in the meantime, at that time, there weren't really environmental beats like there are today. There were a few. And of course, climate change wasn't really a topic yet. So there was no, it was a thing, but it wasn't a journalistic beat. And so my first beat, I covered Florida's prisons. I actually witnessed electrocutions in Florida's electric chair when I was pretty young, in my early 20s. So back then, it was very unusual to see a newspaper or any other outlet devote an entire beat to the environment. But I figured out opportunities to cover environmental issues whenever I could. So I remember, you know, even when I was covering the prison system, I covered things like pollution, and I covered a hazardous waste incinerator that had been proposed near one of the prisons. I was always finding ways to cover this area that I was really passionate about and that I felt was undercovered. And I did that pretty much in every beat I had until I was finally able to carve out a career as a full-time environmental journalist.
Wow. Thank you for sharing. Following those experiences in 2003, you decided to return to UF to earn your master's degree in environmental history. So what followed was being a Knight Wallace Fellow at the University of Michigan. I'm curious, what inspired you to return to academia?
Yeah, so that was sort of, it was learning about how much of Florida had been covered with water at statehood. So at statehood, Florida was more than half submerged, and sort of the environmental history of Florida, what the modern history of Florida was, you know, people and developers coming in and getting rid of water and getting rid of water and getting rid of water at every turn. That's what we did to make this place livable. This kind of interesting thing happened. I was learning that history while I was covering a major drought that was happening at the time. And developers, this was in Southwest Florida, developers had suddenly been told that they could not get new water permits. In other words, so much water had been gotten rid of that now there wasn't enough water to do more development. And it was kind of that irony that the same group of people who got rid of all the water in the first place had now become desperate to find it. It was that sort of irony. It was like, someone needs to write this. And it was that irony that led to me earning a master's degree in environmental history, which, by the way, wasn't a thing here at the time. Now we have the fantastic environmental historian Jack Davis, who is also a Pulitzer Prize winning environmental author. At that time, we didn't have an environmental historian per se, but some of the historians in the history department here, particularly the late David Colburn, who was my mentor, sort of put together independent study for me to be able to research environmental history both nationally and in Florida. And that was really fulfilling.
So your master's thesis and your Knight Wallace Fellowship led to your first book, Mirage, Florida and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern U.S. How do you balance the scientific complexity with emotional resonance when writing for a general audience, people that maybe aren't so close to the subject matter? And where was this water disappearing to, in fact?
Yeah. So the science versus resonance is really a crucial question. That is the crucial question in our field. We're essentially translating science and other complexities for the general audience and finding ways to draw audiences to those complicated stories. So we know there are a lot of good ways to draw people in. So that might include writing about pocketbook issues or writing about things people really love, like animals, or covering shared values, things that we all value, like clean water and the wild places that we love. I don't want to forget your very good question about where the water was disappearing to.
I'm assuming it's osmosis.
That's what we call the subhead, Florida and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern U.S. That's been criticized sometimes because, of course, if you've studied hydrology, you know water never disappears. But when humans, that's the hydrological cycle. When humans are inserted, I like to call it the hydroillogical cycle. Very, very strange things happen, including disappearing water. So when people are involved, water can disappear. When you think about a wetland becoming a drugstore, or when a spring shed is mined and the spring dries up. So one of the most powerful experiences I ever had as a reporter was hiking through the dry spring bed of this huge spring, one-time spring in central Florida called Kissingen Springs. I hiked through the dry, weed-covered spring bed with elderly Floridians who had grown up there and had done cannonballs into this water in their youth. And just to hear them talk about that vanished water. This one elderly woman said she could still remember the goosebumps that she got when she dove into the water when she was walking through this dry spring bed. And so I am here to tell you that water can vanish when we misuse it, when we overpump, when we mine too much, when we dam it, when we drain it. It disappears from the places where it occurred naturally. Which can become a big problem later when there's a drought and you miss that water that was being stored for drinking water or serving as a nursery for small fish or whatever good work it's doing.
So we mentioned Mirage, but can you tell us a little bit about your book author career? What's your favorite book you've written? Or is that asking like if you have a favorite child?
Yeah, so the way I've come to think about my book author career is that I am following the water cycle. So I started with Mirage. I've written about surface water. I wrote a biography of rain. It's called Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. It is the story of rain from the rains that filled the oceans 4 billion years ago to the modern story of climate change. And I then wrote about the sea in my latest book. And I will admit, it is like asking your favorite child, and I feel a little badly answering, but I will admit that Rain is my favorite book. I love rain, which is, I'm called a pluviophile. Mm. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Do either of you love rain, or does that sound crazy to you?
I'm neutral on planning. I'll go running in the rain, but I don't know if I see it.
I do enjoy it when it rains.
Yeah.
I do love it. I do think I do.
Yeah. So I love rain, and that's one reason it's my favorite book. But the other thing is that book really gave me my voice as a writer, because before then, I think my writing in my first two books was still a bit wonkier. Like each of those first two books has an entire chapter on water economics, because the scientists told me all the important things, and I dutifully included all the important things. By the time I wrote the Rain book, the thing I kept telling myself in my head was poetry instead of pipelines. Mm-hmm. So I was really focusing on, you know, the science is all there, but it's blended with the scent of rain and the poetry of rain and all of those wonderfully human things, because that is what people want to read. People want to read the human stories.
Not the stock market on rain.
That's really beautiful. I think it also connects people connect to it more
in
that way.
Yeah, for sure.
But yes, in your latest book, The Sound of the Sea, seashells become a lens for ocean decline. What inspired this approach, and how did you choose the stories that make the cut?
So I was, after I had written Rain, I was sort of kicking around how am I going to write about the ocean? I knew I wanted my next book to be about the ocean, and I was invited to speak at this wonderful little seashell museum on Sanibel Island. It's called the Bailey Matthews National Shell Museum, and I was speaking there, I think I was speaking there about rain, and after the talk, the director invited me out to dinner, and over dinner, she told me this really disturbing story, which was that the museum had surveyed visitors to find out how much visitors already knew about seashells. These were mostly tourists visiting Florida with their children. And the survey showed that 90% of visitors didn't know that a seashell was made by a living animal. Most people thought it was some kind of a rock or stone. And I was so floored by that statistic and so disturbed by it, I tossed and turned in my bed that night. And by the time I woke up, I knew that I wanted to write my next book about seashells and what seashells do for me as a writer. They are this touchstone that really brings people together to be able to talk about pretty wonky issues like ocean warming or ocean acidification. So and you asked me, how did I choose the seashells? That was so hard because there are like more than 50,000 marine mollusks in the world. These are the animals that build seashells. Using minerals from the surrounding sea, which is why they're really impacted by ocean acidification. But anyway, the way I chose was that I picked the 12 most iconic seashells I could to be able to tell human stories. So again, people like to read about other people. So I strove to find the shells whose lives had been most intertwined with humanity. For example, there's a shell called the money cowrie that served as money far longer than any coin or paper money. So I told a pretty epic story about the first global money by telling the story of that little white seashell. Anyway, what's amazing about it is how those stories have helped me talk with people about the kinds of things that are happening to the oceans now. Just last week, I had been invited to Panama City to speak to a group about seashells. You know, they brought me there because they were very excited about seashells, and they were a pretty elderly, pretty conservative audience. And when I started talking about some of the things that are happening to these animals that make the shells, you could just see all these light bulbs going off, and they asked a lot of questions, and they were kind of really keenly interested in climate change and talking about other things. And that's so nice to see because climate change has been so politicized. So it's kind of great to see both as a writer and a speaker when people can come together around a shared value or a touchstone. Yeah.
So we heard you're working on your fifth book and you're actually doing some traveling for it this upcoming week. So can you give us a little bit of a sneak peek?
Yeah, so I'm just now committed to finishing the water cycle. So my new book is called, the working title is The Sea Beneath Us, The Hidden History and Coming Crisis of Groundwater. So The Sea Beneath Us pays homage to a book by Rachel Carson called The Sea Around Us. She was a giant in our field who sounded the early warnings about the dangers of chemical pesticides. And we read her work in environmental journalism class. She also wrote very beautifully about water and animals and the sea. So The Sea Beneath Us is all about groundwaters and aquifers, the kind of hidden water beneath our feet that most of us rely on for drinking water. And again, now having figured out how to draw people to water stories. I'll just tell you quickly, one of the things I'm doing in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to Ireland to visit this spring that had been considered a healing spring for more than 2,000 years. And this spring was specifically known for healing madness or mental illness.
I think I need to visit.
Me too. That's really why I'm going. So for 2,000 years, people would travel from all over when they were suffering from mental illness to try to be cured at this spring. It has this amazing reputation that continues. In modern times, when scientists tested that water, it had high levels of lithium. And so it just goes to show that so many of these ancient stories that about water and springs and holy wells and other things, they really have some basis in reality. And so those stories, you know, this story involves a mad king and all kinds of exciting things from ancient history. So those, by telling the story of that spring, it's a way for me to help draw readers to this beautiful but hidden story of what's happening to our groundwater.
I'm Glenn Richards from WUFT Amplified. If you're like me, you appreciate how special the local music scene is here in North Central Florida, featuring indie rock, hip-hop, bluegrass, and so much more. WUFT Amplified is Florida's music series, filmed right here in Weimer Hall. This show rocks, guys, seriously. And you might not realize that WUFT Amplified is produced entirely by UFCJC staff and students. To watch past episodes and discover your new favorite bands, check out WUFT.org/amplified.
So in 2015, you officially returned to UF as environmental journalist in residence. What did it mean to come back to Weimer Hall in this capacity now, helping students and coaching up the journalists of the future?
Yeah, so that was just an incredible honor to be asked to come back and develop an environmental journalism class. The really funny thing is that I was absolutely certain I would be here for only 1 year. Mm. That first class I taught was spring 2015. It was amazing. That was an amazing class. Some of the people in that class included Alex Harris, who is now senior climate reporter at the Miami Herald. She was, in fact, the first local climate change reporter in the country. Dr. Hannah Brown was in that class. She went on to found a wonderful environmental nonprofit journalistic platform called The Marjorie with some other women. So it was a fantastic first class, and it was an incredible honor to be asked to come back. And what happened was that the field, I mentioned earlier that this was kind of a stepchild field. It was not taken seriously by editors when I was you guys' age. And now, in the meantime, because of the climate crisis, this field was finally being taken very seriously. And every major newspaper and other media outlet finally started hiring, you know, more environmental reporters and even full-time climate reporters. So that is, I mean, first of all, just loving teaching, but then finally, the importance of this story is being seen in the profession. So here I am 10 years later after being sure I would only be here a year.
Well, and not only that, but Teacher of the Year. So can you kind of speak to what is it about being an instructor and working with younger individuals who are trying to get those initial skills? What is it you enjoy the most about?
Oh, yeah. It's just, I can hardly express how much I love teaching. I mean, I always loved journalism, and I love being an author. And that was what I thought, that was the great honor of my life. And it turns out that being a teacher is the great honor of my life. I love it. I love that the students in this college want to, you know, kind of get their boots muddy and get out there. They really love getting out there and telling stories. And in my courses, we do hands-on reporting. We do hands-on projects that are actually published, and they actually make a difference. So the most satisfying thing is sort of seeing the students who have come through these classes become some of the most compelling environment and climate storytellers in the whole country. I just am, you know, so moved seeing their work. And even those who graduated 10 years ago or last semester, I'm always texting with them and reading their work and seeing their latest scoop. And that's just a great honor.
Eventually, you became the director of Climate and Environment Journalism Initiatives. Why is the subject matter so important right now, especially?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things that make it important. It's not only the climate crisis and the, you know, other ecological crises, including water quality and extinction and all the other things that are happening to the world. It is all that, but it's also the political nature of all that, how much it has been politicized and how much it has been subject to, you know, disinformation and misinformation. So it's become all that much more important to not only cover these stories, but to cover these stories in ways that build trust and kind of bring people together, again, around shared values for protecting clean water and air and kind of, you know, leaving a place for the next generation. So all of that is terrifically important. And so in addition to teaching courses and overseeing student projects, I also helped found WUFT's Environment and Ag Desk, on which we have a wonderful Report for America Corn member named Rose Schnabel, who does an excellent job covering environment and agriculture and climate change here in North Central Florida. So that feels really important to me to kind of help solve the crisis of news deserts and local journalism. I really want to be involved in the solutions there, because the more, you know, people want to read about their local community, and the more we can localize news and build trust and help people understand what's happening in their backyard, the more they do, you know, understand what's happening to the climate. It's much easier to understand things like warming and extreme rains and things like that when you're experiencing it and when you understand it in your backyard and how it's impacting your neighbors, you know, rather than hearing these obscure terms that are kind of, you know, or global stories. So I'm very excited to be kind of involved in not just teaching, but also being part of the news operations here at WUFT.
In the current role that you have, what are some courses that you're currently teaching?
Yeah, so the courses that I teach are environmental journalism, which I teach every fall. And then in the spring, I teach advanced environment science and health journalism. And that is often a project where the class spends the entire semester on one investigation of some sort. So previous classes have devoted the semester to, for example, clean water in Florida, to the fertilizer industry. Last semester, we devoted the semester to kind of the limits of ecotourism and whether there's even such a thing as sustainable tourism. And that class took a spring break trip to Costa Rica, and I was really proud of the depth of the reporting that they did on those topics and the how many local people they really pulled into those complex topics. So I teach those classes that are kind of crunchy and serious, and I also teach magazine and feature writing. And what I love about teaching magazine and feature writing is that while it can be very, you know, it can include really complex and serious topics like climate change, but it can also include lighter topics such as spray tanning or lip gloss, both of which I recently helped students tackle. I think it really speaks to the importance of being able to appreciate light and even silly topics in really serious times. So I think it's important to be able to hold in your hand both the seriousness of what's happening to the world and to people and to the climate, and the silliness that happens in everyday life and kind of the ridiculousness of things. I think it's important to be able to hold on to both. And so I love teaching magazine and feature writing just for the kind of kind of the arc of topics that we can cover. And I think that's the beauty of journalism too. Being able to read the box scores along with what is happening with the planet.
On this note, how do you approach teaching environmental journalism to students who might feel overwhelmed by the climate crisis and maybe the lack of control and power they have over the circumstances?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The beauty of this work that I really try to stress is that this work saves things. That history of what we got right in the past is really crucial. So accountability reporting on the environment and on the climate crisis can save people. It can save animals. It can save places. Several years ago, when Max Chesnas was in my class, we did a project on a wild island near St. Augustine called Fish Island. It was slated for development, and our environmental journalism class chose to devote the entire semester to publishing stories about Fish Island, including its vulnerability to sea rise and how it was believed to contain graves of enslaved people. And those graves would be destroyed, of course, if it were developed. The island was saved, and the citizens who were working on it really gave the students a lot of credit. The students and their stories got a lot of credit for that island being saved and actually purchased. Anyway, Max, one of the lead students on that story, he's now with the Tampa Bay Times, and he was the reporter who broke the recent story about hotels and pickleball courts in state parks with the help of a whistleblower. So his journalism helped stop that plan and helped change the law to protect the parks. And he told me that he had that same feeling. He had that same feeling that he had in the class, that like, wow, this work can help save something. It can help save things. And I think there's no more empowering feeling you can have than rolling up your sleeves and feeling like the work you're doing, even if it's about a small island or a state park, is making a difference. That is the best antidote to that feeling of sadness about what's happening with the climate and that feeling of being overwhelmed.
So what advice would you give to future climate journalists? Maybe they're in your class, maybe they're just listening, but how do we motivate them and inspire them?
Yeah, so one piece of advice I give a lot is to remember to balance warning and wonder in roughly equal parts. So we know that when people read what is sometimes called doomsday climate reporting, we know that just shuts people down. They don't want to read that, but not only that, it's not even true, because there are so many hope spots. There are hope spots in the oceans. There are hope spots on land. There are hopeful stories even coming out of the extinction crisis. So I think it's really important to, when you're writing about something devastating, to always find a little bit of wonder somewhere. If you're writing about an animal that's going extinct, or I keep saying the word writing because I'm a writer, but Matt, you're a videographer. We're doing a podcast. This is all very much multimedia. I'm really talking about reporting, video reporting, audio reporting, interactive data reporting, all the ways now that we can tell these stories well beyond writing. Anyway, it's just really important to balance wonder every time. Even if you were writing about the manatee die-offs, for example, there's going to be a way in that story to tell your audience something absolutely wondrous about manatees that blows your mind, right? There's always that little detail that you can find, and that really will help keep your audience with you. The second thing would be to find touchstones and those shared values that kind of draw us together around the things we love and the things we want to protect. And the last thing would be just going back to that point I made about us being able to save things. Journalism makes a difference, and their journalism will make a difference. It always has. It does now. And it's just such an honor to be in this field. I love it, and I'm really excited to be helping share it with another generation of journalists.
Interesting you mentioned the positive things and developments. I recently, I mean, just a couple of days ago, saw a study that said that it turns out fish are more resilient to climate change than was initially expected, that they are doing actually quite well in warmer and colder water than was projected initially. So it's kind of interesting that the doom and gloom and the over-expecting of the bad
Sometimes
doesn't come to fruition.
Yeah, I think that's really important to teach students, right? So that really came out when I was reporting on the Seashell book. You know, yes, there were all these stories about how ocean acidification, all these research studies, early research studies about how ocean acidification was making it harder for marine mollusks and other mollusks to build their shells. But what is happening kind of in the longer arc of the research is to see how animals are adapting to acidification, to see how animals are adapting to warmer oceans. And no doubt, you know, not to underplay the dire seriousness of both ocean warming and acidification, but only to say, Matt, you're absolutely right that life persists. Life wants to persist, and animals are adapting and evolving to change. And that's a really important part of the story.
And in ways that we're only realizing now as they're evolving.
Yes.
Related to the Costa Rica trip,
mm-hmm.
Where can people see those stories published? And I mean, is it just work, or are you guys having a good time while you're there too?
Students usually have a good time wherever they go. I was thinking to myself, I've spent the last three spring breaks ago, I took students to what's known as Cancer Alley in Louisiana to see the impact of chemical plants on what are largely poor communities and communities of color. And, you know, they kind of went into these communities and interviewed a lot of people and did great reporting. But yes, we also danced at Tipitina's. So there, you know, you remember you got to balance the wonder and the warning, right? Then two spring breaks ago, I was on a research vessel with students in an honors class called Honoring the Ocean. And yes, I will admit to having a lot of fun on that trip, even though we were learning about ocean acidification and other very serious topics. And then, yes, this spring break, we were reporting on the limits of ecotourism, but we definitely had fun and did, you know, lots of hiking, saw lots of animals and beautiful waters, and hiked up a volcano. I mean, it was an interesting juxtaposition, right? Because we were reporting on ecotourism and we were part of the problem, right? Because we were experiencing ecotourism. So that's all an important part of the conversation. Like, how can you avoid falling into the worst of what we call parachute journalism, where you parachute into a place and don't really know what you're talking about and start, dispatching stories from there. So they do a lot of work before we ever leave to research places and to interview local people before we are ever on the ground to make sure to avoid some of those problems. But yeah, this field, it's fun and satisfying, even though the topics are sometimes really, really sad and even devastating.
In terms of the messaging that you want the general audiences who are reading this or consuming environmental journalist content, what is it that you think they can do to interact with the environment or with the cause of promoting this information? Is it a matter of just staying informed? What do you think people should strive to do?
Yeah, so I will say that I am not a prescriptive or preachy person generally. I mean, I think it's really important for journalists to stay, neutral and interview scientists and interview all experts. One thing we talk a lot about in my class is expanding our definition of experts and how like people are often the experts in their local community. So the key here is to interview as many people as you can who are involved and do the research, and then every story will have its own set of hopefully solutions. Like, it is really important to weave solutions into all stories and to not just, you know, be running around dredging up problems without offering hope and pretty specific details for what people can do or do differently. But that's not something that I kind of enter my stories with. That is something, you know, I'm out there interviewing scientists and asking them and doing research on the solutions, or, you know, talking with people in a community about what's most important to them.
Drilling down further, pun intended, most of the work that we do, we think of our audience when we're developing the story from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, who do you envision as your audience? Or is it different for every work? Or are you kind of building for this proxy audience member? and what are you trying to give them that they need in their life?
Yeah, I do have an audience in mind. And I've thought about this for maybe even 20 years or so. I've thought of this audience in my mind. I think of this audience as the caring middle. And these are people, and I guess I think about my own family, because these are people who may not know that something is harming water or harming fish or harming wildlife or harming the earth, and certainly harming people. Once they know, they would be willing to live differently. And so I think of my audience as the caring middle. I think of people in my own family. I actually have climate deniers in my own family. And so I think about ways that I can and do talk with them and connect with them about places we love to go or water we enjoy together and so on. And so that's how I think of audience. It's kind of, it is a bit broad, and it's exactly what you said. It's so important to think about audience from the beginning of this process to publication. And audiences are fragmented now. So our students are going to go out and work for all different kinds of platforms and be reporting for vastly different audiences. So that's why I try to teach generally to this idea of the caring middle. Think about this caring aunt that you have, or whoever it is who may not understand the details of this chemical, but if she knew the details of this chemical, she probably wouldn't want her dog to drink it or to put it near a waterway and so on. I hope that answer made sense.
Yeah, so your audience is well-intentioned, but maybe doesn't have all the information.
Yeah. Which is who we all are, right? That's who I am too. I'm well-intentioned, and I don't always have the information, so I'm going out and trying to find it.
Excellent. One of the things that I've heard from a lot of folks is that in the media field, we get access, in some cases, to people, places, things that otherwise we would have no real justification for having access to, in doing our stories and doing our reporting. Are there any instances that you can think of where you got to experience something or be somewhere that otherwise wouldn't have happened?
I can think of a lot of instances, and one, I'll tell you one that's kind of gross and funny, and then I'll tell you one that was really wondrous. So something that happens to environmental journalists a lot is that we always will end up eventually at the sewage treatment plant. I mean, when you write enough about water, you know, some engineer really wants you to come see the sewage treatment plant and all the, you know, all the stuff they're doing to treat the sewage and all the things we shouldn't be flushing down the toilet. And so I've seen like way more than my share of sewage treatment plants, not just here, but all over the country. So that's one funny thing. But the kind of wondrous place that I think I got a taste of that maybe the general public hasn't seen is at the Vizcaya Mansion in Coral Gables. Have you heard of Vizcaya? Just this gorgeous, wonderful place overlooking the bay. And, you know, the architecture and the statues and the landscapes, it's all epic. But because I had written the seashell book and because I spoke there about the seashell book, I was invited way down into the basement where there is an extraordinary shell grotto. It looks like something out of the 18th century royal court where they had commissioned an artist, and this was probably in the early 20th century. It was surely more than 100 years old. And I say basement, but it's actually like this subterranean area of pools and underground together. And there is a glorious shell grotto down there with thousands and thousands and thousands of seashells. And it needs to be restored. It had been shuttered to the general public because it was kind of it was not safe for the public to trudge through there, but it's going to be restored. So I got a look at this grotto and I just loved seeing it because in the seashell book I did write about the great shell grottos. Like there had been shell grottos at Versailles and many other great castles of Europe. There's no longer a shell grotto at Versailles. So it was really neat to see it at Vizcaya, especially when I wasn't expecting it.
How you balance the historical nature of these environmental issues in your writing, if it's something that you incorporate a lot of, or especially to a general audience who may not want to know all the historical.
That's a great question. I lean really heavily into environmental history. Mm-hmm. I love history. I earned my master's degree in environmental history. I feel that it's very important in my stories and as a teacher. So in my courses, students learn things like the fact that we nearly dammed the Grand Canyon. So most students who have not taken environmental history don't know that we nearly dammed the Grand Canyon. That's really important to know, right? Because you need to know that bad ideas can be quashed. And in fact, it's happened all the time and it needs to keep happening. And so I devote an entire week of the 16-week semester to history of the environment and history of environmental journalism specifically, which goes back to the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution and people who were kind of advocating to move this heavy smoke emitting industry out of the city of London, kind of to the outskirts, which did eventually happen. So I find history important as a teacher and as a journalist, and my books are all known for including a lot of history. That really is an important facet for each of my books. And the best thing about it is that audiences love it. Like audiences love the history of the first global money that I tell in the seashell book. They love this story. One of my favorite stories is about a 19th century curio shop dealer in the East End of London named Marcus Samuel Sr., who sold seashells in a little shop in the East End. His little shop became the largest oil company in the world when his sons took it over and named it Shell Oil. So I love history, and I find that audiences love it.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. That's really cool. Really amazing.
We feel honored to have you here today. So thank you for chatting with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was amazing. Like, genuinely, I think that as someone who hadn't really noticed the environment before coming here to Gainesville, I feel so much more appreciative of it.
Yes.
And I just think it's so important to tell those stories.
Yeah.
It's so crucial to who we are to feel connected to nature. And
yeah,
those stories just help us refocus our energy to it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. It's been wonderful to talk with you.
The Communicator Podcast is a production of U.S. College of Journalism and Communications. This episode is produced by Elizabeth Inswasti. Thanks to our guest, Cynthia Barnett. Hosted by Matt Abramson and featuring Elizabeth Inswasti. Special thanks to WUFT. Go Gators!